I'm Divya Shekhar, and this is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. What if I tell you that there's a startup that can scrape every photo that you casually upload on social media, even random public images like you at a traffic signal or a concert, for instance? Or what if I tell you there's a company that uses powerful facial recognition technology in ways that even big tech companies like Google and Facebook have refrained from using? New York Times journalist Kashmir Hill's new book, Your Face Belongs to Us, is an investigation into the inner workings of one such controversial facial recognition startup. It's an alarming narrative about the threats posed by unrestrained use of facial recognition technology and its impact on our privacy. Listen up. Kashmir, I'm really excited to be speaking with you today. Welcome to From the Bookshelves of Forbes India.
Thanks for having me on.
So I found your book and your investigation to be extremely fascinating. To give our listeners some context, your book, which is called Your Face Belongs to Us, is about the startup called Clearview AI, which is into facial recognition. You just have to upload a photograph of a person in it, and it will show you results scraped from every presence that individual might have on the internet. So can you tell us more about the startup? Like, who are the people behind it? How many faces do they have on their database? And what's the scope and scale like?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised to find that it is, when they first started, a very tiny startup, really just a ragtag crew of mix of individuals interested in technology and business and just trying to find a new angle to make money. The technical co-founder is a guy named Juan Tan Tat. He grew up in Australia, dropped out of college at 19 years old to move to San Francisco and just try to make his way in the tech world. Eventually wound up in New York, where he met his co-founders for Clearview AI. They have scraped 30 billion faces from the internet. So they have quite a large database that, of course, is more people than live on the planet. So they have a number of photos for each person.
That's a lot. 30 billion is a lot.
Yeah. I mean, there's the thing is that there's so many photos on the internet to be scraped. And I think that most of us, when we were putting these photos online, you know, on social media websites, on education websites, on sites like Flickr, you know, we weren't thinking that someone would come along and scrape them and build this tool that would make the internet searchable by face.
Right. I mean, so they can only access publicly available photographs, right? Or do you know if they can sort of strike up deals to get other information as well that's not public? Like if I have a private Instagram account, for example, would they be able to access photos from there?
They say they only scrape public images. What I have seen happen is if your Instagram, you know, account was public at some point and they scraped it then, and then you made it private, they would still have those images.
Could you talk a bit more about scraping, like the method that they use to get information about people on the internet? You have a few lines in your book about what the history of scraping is as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, scraping has been going on since the very beginning of the internet. I mean, when the World Wide Web was first founded, there were people that would send these kind of spiders or automated programs out to collect information about other websites that were on the internet back when it was very, very tiny. You know, it is scraping is just the act of sending an automated bot to a website and having it download information en masse. And so, you know, Juan Tan Tat told me one of the very first websites he scraped was a company called Venmo. They're a social payments network.
Yeah.
And they had on their website transactions that were happening on their network between individuals who had public accounts. And it was a real-time feed of what was happening on the social network. And he would just send his bot to that website every few seconds and download the photos and the links to the profile pages. And it was like I compare it to a slot machine in the book in a casino where you pull the lever and you just win every time with faces spilling out.
In fact, there's an interesting chapter about how Juan Tan Tat taught himself everything by going online. He's self-taught, and you know how it's also sort of on the backs of, you know, what these large tech companies and the open source academicians and researchers were putting out, right?
Yeah, he benefited from kind of the open technology culture. As a kid, he watched coding videos that were put out by the big American university, MIT. That's kind of how he initially taught himself to code. And then, you know, as he was working at Clearview AI, he told me he was just following, you know, machine learning experts on Twitter, now known as X, and yeah. looking on GitHub for resources about facial recognition algorithms. You know, he described it to me as standing on the shoulders of giants. He was taking advantage of a lot of open source technology, code that is freely shared. And really what set him apart, what set Clearview AI apart, was not so much that they made a technological breakthrough, but that they were willing to do what other companies like Google and Facebook hadn't been willing to do, to take all of these photos and apply a facial recognition algorithm to them.
In fact, you mentioned that in your book as well, that, you know, tech companies like Facebook and Google have this technology with them, but they've decided to sort of draw that line. And you also quote a quantum physicist, Hartmut Neven, who I think worked with Google on their facial recognition goggles. And he says, and I quote, that people are asking for facial recognition all the time. But as an established company like Google, you have to be way more conservative than a little startup that has nothing to lose. Mm. I think that sort of sent chills down my spine, like startups that have nothing to lose. So is that what it comes down to in this day and age when it comes to privacy?
Yeah, I mean, that I think is one of the big lessons of this book as we're entering this new realm of AI, generative AI, and just all these other tools that we are open sourcing them and allowing, you know, everybody to access the models, because there's this desire for democracy, you know, a democratic approach to technology. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the big monopolies that have these kind of powerful tools, but that does open the door to companies like Clearview AI to be radical actors, to do what other big tech companies aren't willing to do, and define the kind of define the limits of the technology.
You know, I was quite surprised as I was reading your book, and there were a lot of things that I didn't know. For like this startup, for instance, has Peter Thiel and Naval Ravikant as investors. And this is a company that worked in sort of stealth mode. It was clearly sort of by invite. Yet I was surprised to see how many rich and powerful people continued to use it for their own means and reasons, for example. And they did not flag it. Like, for example, the Sequoia Capital MD, Doug Leone, American football quarterback Joe Montana, actor Ashton Kutcher. There are so many people, right? Like, what does that say about, you know?
Well, it really reminded me of this very famous quote by William Gibson, a science fiction author. And he said, "The future is here. It's just not very evenly distributed." And it is, I felt like I was seeing that with Clearview AI, that they were approaching rich and powerful people because that is initially who they wanted to sell their facial recognition tool to. And it was, the stories were really incredible. I mean, these people were using it at work conferences to, you know, remember people's first names. One of the investors, a billionaire who lives in New York City, who owns grocery stores, Clearview approached him about putting the technology in the grocery stores to catch shoplifters, but he also got to have the app on his phone. And he was telling me how he was out to dinner one night at an Italian restaurant in downtown Manhattan, and his daughter walked in with a man that he didn't recognize, and they were on a date. And so he had the waiter go over and take a photo of the couple, and then ran the guy's, you know, face through Clearview AI to find out who he was. And he told me he wanted to make sure he wasn't a charlatan.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was, and they actually sort of made light of the whole situation, right? In the book, I think when you quote the daughter as well, I mean, it was all taken in a much lighter way, in, I suppose, the entire incident.
And yeah, she thought it was funny. But meanwhile, the billions of faces, the people that they belong to, they had no idea they're in this database. We didn't even know it existed because Clearview AI was very much trying to keep what they had done, you know, a secret when I first found out about them.
You know, in fact, you had a tough time, you know, getting on to them, or, you know, finding out just who owns this app when you first started looking into this. And I think the people who sort of, you told them to sort of upload your photograph on it, they immediately got a call from the company saying, why are you trying to upload the photo? And I think their accounts got blocked and things like that, right? You write it in the preface of your book.
Yes, exactly. Clearview AI eventually started selling the facial recognition tool to police officers, to police departments actually around the world. And I, when the company wouldn't talk to me, I ended up approaching police officers to see if they would tell me about the technology. And they were very enthusiastic about it. They said it worked like no other facial recognition tool they'd had access to before, that was very good at identifying people, and offered to demonstrate it for me. But each time that would happen, the officer would ghost me. He would stop talking to me. And eventually I found out that Clearview AI had put an alert on my face and that they were getting a notification every time this happened. And they were reaching out to officers and telling them, don't talk to her. In one case, they did deactivate a detective's account. And this was chilling to me because it showed, wow, Clearview AI knows who officers are looking for. At one point, they blocked my face from having results. So they could control whether you could be found. And it just shows how facial recognition technology can be deployed to track people that you think are pesky or annoying or kind of enemies. And we're already seeing that playing out in the real world. Facial recognition technology kind of being weaponized. One of the prime examples of this is here in New York City. There's a big event venue called Madison Square Garden. Yeah. It's where big sports teams play. It's where, you know, all the big musicians, you know, U2 has concerts there. And the owner installed facial recognition technology a few years ago to keep out security threats. Right. But over the last year, he decided this would also be a really powerful way to keep out my enemies, namely lawyers who worked at firms that had sued him. And so the company scraped their photos from their law firm websites and put thousands of lawyers on a ban list so that they couldn't come to events at the venue anymore until they dropped their lawsuits. And it's just such a good example of surveillance creep or function creep, that when you set up these kind of surveillance infrastructures to address security threats, they often get repurposed to address other concerns, such as protesters, dissenters, tracking your enemies, tracking your rivals. And so it's a reason why a technology like this, while powerful, really needs guardrails to protect the kind of world that we want to live in.
Right. But why has sort of no one taken action against them? I mean, have people sued them? Or in fact, I think very recently they won a $9 million privacy appeal in the UK, right?
So Clearview AI has been sued. It has been sued in a few different states here in the United States, and then privacy regulators outside of the United States investigated them in Europe, in Canada, in Australia. And they all found that what Clearview AI did was illegal, that it broke their privacy laws, which say that you can't collect people's, sensitive biometric information without their consent. And Clearview AI stopped doing business in those countries. Meanwhile, here in the United States, we just don't have a privacy law like that at the federal level. It's more at the state level. But several of these regulators fined Clearview AI, and quite significant fines, up to 20 million euros per country that fined them. And they have been fighting it. They've been appealing. And they did just manage to, as you said, overturn the fine in the UK, because a higher court there said that UK's privacy regulator doesn't have the right to control foreign government's use of their citizens' data. So because Clearview AI is working with US law enforcement, they're kind of exempted from the UK privacy rules.
Right. What kind of precedent does that set?
Well, it does show that if these kind of privacy invading companies are primarily working with law enforcement, that can be a get out of jail free card for them. And I do suspect that may be the way that this goes, that we have greater kind of controls and regulations over how companies and individuals use this technology. But governments may have may have much greater access and freer rein. But again, I do think that we need to address that and think about what guardrails we want for government, because sure, it's a good use case to use facial recognition technology like this to identify a suspected murderer or someone guilty of assault or home invasion. But, you know, it could also be the case that this technology was rolled out on all surveillance cameras, you know, all around a city or a country or a world. We've already seen that happen in Moscow, in Russia, in parts of China. And it can become very chilling when you are tracking people all of the time. And you do see that surveillance creep. For example, in China, you know, they rolled out this surveillance to, you know, to address security threats, but now they use it to automatically ticket jaywalkers, to name and shame people who wear pajamas in public. I mean, it can quickly get very dystopian, when you have the surveillance kind of built out to that degree.
In fact, there was a 2022 study, I think, by I read it on this website called Comparitech, that tracks the extent of facial recognition technology in countries around the world. And, you know, not surprisingly, India is also among the top countries to use facial recognition technologies for various purposes. And I was surprised that, you know, it's even used in workplaces and schools and in public transport. So, you know, where do we draw the line in, you know, how can countries make sure that their governments or the officials, they use the technology ethically or responsibly?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there need to be rules set. I think there's clearly good use cases, and that at least that we're seeing that in the United States, that a lot of police departments are starting to use this to try to solve crimes. But even then, you need rules, because we are not all unique snowflakes. People do look similar. And so you need to make sure that you're doing more investigating than just making sure that somebody matches in a facial recognition search, because we have seen in the United States a handful of people who have been falsely arrested for the crime of looking like someone else. It does need to be kind of paired with a robust investigation. And then I think just, yeah, setting rules about, I personally think the idea of facial recognition just on all the surveillance cameras tracking everybody all the time is very chilling. And I think that most people would be uncomfortable living in that kind of panopticon where you're always watched, because then you lose kind of your sense of freedom and anonymity. And I think we all appreciate that in our daily lives, this ability to kind of move through space, and not, you know, be constantly tracked. My great fear with facial recognition technology is that it will take the kind of tracking that already happens to us online, right? Yeah. Like when you go from website to website, like everything you search, everything you click, it's all, you know, tracked and traced. My fear is that will be transferred to the real world, and that our faces will be this token that can be used to, you know, constantly track us, to constantly just identify us and attach all this information to the face, kind of like at Madison Square Garden, where they're able to see the moment you work for the door, through the door, who you work for, and then discriminate against you based on that.
I've often thought about this multiple times, right? Like many a times, like we've sort of gotten used to the fact that, you know, when we go online, there are websites that collect our data. You know, when we go on Instagram, we see, you know, ad recommendations based on something that, you know, that we've searched, or, you know, and people have sort of found a way to sort of be okay with this. And I know for a fact that in a few places there are face scans, and, you know, and nobody really questions them. When we step up the facial recognition, the use of facial recognition technologies, I mean, do sort of people really care? And, you know, are they really aware of what's happening? I mean, you know, how do people learn to recognize what is sort of okay and what is not?
Well, I mean, I think there's some clearly beneficial uses of facial recognition, like those of us who use it to open our phone or to access certain services. You know, there's ways in which facial recognition technology can be used by you for your convenience. And that is different from when it's used on you, particularly without your awareness, being used to judge you, to discriminate against you. I put those kind of two uses of facial recognition technologies into kind of different baskets. And right. Yeah, I mean, this is the hard thing about privacy in general, is that people don't often know what they're giving up until it comes back to harm them in some way. And so it is the biggest challenge of privacy, is that one, you don't know, you know, what's being collected, and you don't know how it might hurt you in the future. Even just facial recognition technology itself, you know, what I was saying earlier, we all put our photos onto the internet, not thinking through that this would happen, that technology would improve and make it possible to organize and find all those photos and associate them with you. And not just photos that you put up yourself, but other photos. When I've had a Clearview AI search run on my face, it's brought up, you know, photos of me at a concert in the background of someone else's photo, walking by on a sidewalk behind somebody else.
That is so scary.
In one case, I was at a public event with a source, and I didn't realize that photo was on the internet. So it is kind of a powerful technology to discern and unearth information about us. And, you know, for a lot of people, they might not start worrying about it until it comes back to hurt them in some way, like the lawyers who all of a sudden can't get into MSG because their photos are on their law firm websites. But I do think that people also do have this kind of, it's part of why I decided to write a book about facial recognition technology. I do feel like people have this awareness or sensitivity about their face, that it's your identity, and the idea of someone else just putting you in their database without your consent and kind of using this, you know, to against you or to unearth information about you. I do feel like people find that creepy on some level. And so, it's more tangible, I guess, than these kind of digital cookies that are following you around on the computer. So I do hope there's more awareness about, you know, what this means for people's privacy and anonymity.
So what's the solution going forward?
Well, I do think that was so interesting that I found in the reporting for the book, is that Google and Facebook could have released a Clearview AI like power years ago, and they decided not to. So there are ethical choices that companies can make about what they want to put out into the world and whether they think it's a good thing or a bad thing. So that is certainly plays a role. And yeah, social norms, like what we think is acceptable. You know, there are Clearview AI is restricted to police use, but there are other public face search engines on the internet right now that people can use. And, you know, people can use them. So, I mean, part of it is us choosing, do we want to start normalizing the use of those things or not? And then policymakers and regulators, do they want to make those types of companies illegal or give us more power? You know, in Europe, they've decided that you as a citizen should have the right to decide whether you're in those databases. And so they've said those databases are illegal if collected without consent. And that is a decision that other countries can make as well, in which case those kinds of companies, what they're doing would become illegal.
Right. Thank you so much for your time, Kashmir. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much for your interest in the book. I loved working on it, and it was really wonderful talking about it with you.
So that's all for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Divya Shekhar. See you next time.